Well, I still remember the morning of November 29th, 1988. That was the day an early morning blast miles distant woke me and tens of thousands of other Kansas Cityans in a tragedy that claimed the lives of six Kansas City firefighters. Mike McGraw, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The Star, who's now with the Hale Center for Journalism at Kansas City Public Television, has been writing about the events of that night for nearly a decade. To him, the events that led up to the blast remain something of a mystery. Questions still need answering, and Mike McGraw says one of them is, are the right people in prison? Now a stage production will explore these issues in this case. Mike McGraw wrote a long first-person piece about his involvement with this story in Wednesday's Star, and he joins me now. And Mike, welcome back.
Good nice to be here, Steve. Thanks.
The explosion occurred in 1988, Mike, and I can't help but wonder now if we will ever get to the bottom of this thing, because as you wrote yesterday, this story is a cesspool of different stories, contradictory stories, recanting witnesses. I mean, it's just flat incredible.
Yeah, there's a lot going on in this story. Now, I've got to say that the federal government that prosecuted these five people who are serving life in prison
stand by their convictions.
They stand by their convictions. Yeah. They think the right people are in jail. But they've also acknowledged in a report that came out in 2011 that an independent investigation sparked by some stories in The Star had found two new perpetrators. I've been attempting to get the U.S. attorney to talk to me since 2011 about, are you going to investigate these two new people? If so, when? And they won't talk about it.
You don't know if they're investigating or not.
Well, you never know with the feds, right?
Yeah, right.
They've hardly, you and I have worked on stories where they
bang my head against a lot of walls with those guys.
Yes. Yeah. They just won't say, but you would think if something would happen, it would have happened by now.
You know, I'm wondering, Mike, why this case grabbed you as hard as it did. I mean, you spent a lot of time with it, and you wrote in the paper yesterday that I think about the case almost every day. Why?
You know, I had never really dived into a court case like this before, a case that could be a wrongful prosecution. I can't say for sure it was. And the more I got into how the courts work and how the courts seek truth compared to how the rest of the world seeks truth, the more bothersome it became to me. And the more facts I dug up, the more recantations there were, the more I wondered, you know, are these people really good for this, or are there other people out there who are walking around free and should be in jail? And now the Justice Department agrees with that.
When you say the way the courts seek truth, you're talking about what?
I'm not an attorney. And many attorneys would probably argue with me, but some defense attorneys would not. But there are a whole set of rules about who can say what, when they can say it. In this particular case, there were 59 prosecution witnesses, many of whom could only testify that one or the other of the five defendants admitted they were involved in some way. But only one witness, every witness could only testify against one defendant. So that meant there was a smaller subset of witnesses against each defendant, like somewhere between five and seven.
Mm-hmm.
When I analyzed all of the prosecution witnesses' statements and put them all next to each other, you quickly realize that some prosecution witnesses would put the same defendant in as many as seven different places at the same time.
Hmm. And then you throw into this mix the notion that some of the folks who testified were already in prison, and they were striking deals with prosecutors for reduced sentences or what have you.
Some were in prison, some were not.
Mm-hmm.
Some were facing federal charges. And
you wonder how that begins to change their stories when they're offered a carrot like that.
Well, it's a matter of public record that many wrongful conviction cases came out of just that kind of situation where a witness was given some kind of an incentive to testify a certain way, and they did. And later it would be proven either through DNA or some other reason that testimony was wrong. I believe one prosecution witness, if I'm not mistaken, got 25 years off a pending sentence.
Mm-hmm. Ultimately, you think the case needs to be reopened to clear all this up. Do I have that right?
Ultimately, I'm quoting one family member, the brother of one of the firefighters who was killed, mm-hmm. As saying, look, there have been enough questions raised now that I think we need either another investigation or a grand jury investigation to clear up all these questions.
But as we sit here today, there are no signs that that's going to happen.
As we sit here today, there are no signs that that's going to happen, although the case is going to come rushing back to the city very soon. And many people remember where they were. I kind of call this the Kennedy assassination of Kansas City. Everybody knows where they were when this explosion occurred. And one of the defendants, Brian Shepard, the youngest one of the five defendants, was a juvenile at the time of the crime,
mm-hmm.
even though he wasn't tried in federal court until 9 years later. Interestingly, he was charged right after the explosion with being involved. The two informants who testified or who told police that he admitted to it while he was in jail with them changed their story and said, we lied. Mm-hmm. They let him go. And then 8 years later, the federal government had indicted him. Well, Brian has asked for a resentencing hearing through his attorney, Cindy Short, based on a Supreme Court case called Miller versus Alabama. Which affects juveniles. That case is based on brain science, which shows that juveniles don't have brains mature enough to make wise decisions. So Brian...
I've had a little experience in my household with that very same phenomenon.
So have I.
We'll leave names out of it for now, but you get my drift.
Right. Yeah. But anyway, the government has acknowledged that in his case, he deserves a resentencing hearing. There is no date set. It could happen sometime this year. It's kind of being held up right now by a challenge to that case over retroactivity. But if a juvenile was sentenced under mandatory sentencing to life in prison, they get a chance at resentencing.
Mike McGraw is my guest. He's a reporter with the Hale Center for Journalism over at Kansas City Public Television, a former reporter for the Kansas City Star. We're talking about the 1988 tragedy that killed six Kansas City firefighters in South Kansas City one morning. You mentioned just a couple minutes ago, Mike, where we all were that morning. And boy, I remember it vividly. I was covering police for the Star in those days. And the first blast woke me up, and I thought, I wasn't quite sure what had just happened, but looked out the window, didn't see anything. But I got my clothes on and began driving. And then the second one went off, and you knew something was very, very amiss in our city that morning. And I think a lot of people had similar experiences.
Right. In fact, I interviewed one fellow, I think he lived in Sugar Creek, that told me that the blast woke him up and caused him to realize that his house was on fire. So in this case, he thinks it saved his life.
Wow.
Although it did take the lives of six very courageous firefighters, and I would not in any way try to minimize the importance of those deaths. It changed the way we fight fires. It changed a lot of things around here. But I also think that it bears continued watching, and there's still these unanswered questions. Interestingly, I think this production, we're doing a one-act play
based on
the case. And interestingly, I do think that's renewing some interest in it. I did not write the script. I'm not a script writer. A very successful local playwright, Michelle T. Johnson, mm-hmm. wrote the script. And I think she does a wonderful job of honoring the firefighters at the same time as raising some important questions about the case.
This production is being put together by the Center for Investigative Reporting in Kansas City's Living Room Theater. They'll present StoryWorks KC, Justice in the Embers. Again, it's an exploration of what happened back in 1988. Michelle T. Johnson wrote it based on the reporting of Mike McGraw. It'll run from February 4th through the 20th. You can get tickets at kcpt.org. That's Kansas City Public Television's website. I'll put that out again in just a few minutes. Mike, let's just slow down here and walk backwards for a moment and talk about what happened on that day in November in 1988. What do we know? Walk us through the events of that morning.
Well, I've always been fascinated with the amount of information that can come out of a short 5-minute period.
It's incredible.
Especially when it goes to court. I mean, the trial transcript is 4,000 pages long. The investigators, both the Kansas City Police and the federal agents, interviewed hundreds, maybe thousands of people, and I've read many of those interviews. All we know for sure is that there were at least two fires set on a construction site at about 87th Street and 71 Highway.
Mm-hmm. The construction site was for what?
It was to widen 71 Highway.
That's when it was being built, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And we also know that that was a non-union construction site, and there had been some labor problems in that area. Mm-hmm. A theory still exists today mm-hmm. that this could have been in some way a union trying to sabotage the site because it was non-union. In fact, the federal government worked for 6 or 7 years on that theory before they changed their theory to these local people who lived in Marlboro mm-hmm. And indicted them. We know that there were two fires. The security guards called in, reported the fires. The firefighters, two pumper trucks showed up. They put out the fire in a pickup truck owned by one of the guards. And then they went up the hill to where a trailer truck, a tractor trailer, was on fire. And they started pouring water on that. And lo and behold, the trailer was full of 25,000 pounds of ANFO. Mm-hmm. Which is a low-grade construction explosive, and hydrous ammonia and fuel oil.
And that's what we heard that morning.
Yes, that was the first explosion, and about 12 minutes later, 18 minutes later, a second trailer full of explosives went.
That was nearby there as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Tell me about the folks who are in prison for this crime. Who are they, and what did they say about their involvement here?
They weren't angels.
Yes, that's one of the issues here.
No, they weren't. I mean, they'd been in trouble. Brian Shepard, the youngest, who's getting a resentencing hearing, probably had the least police record, the shortest police record of all of them. They had been troublemakers in Marlboro, especially the older defendant, Frank Shepard. His brother, Skip, has since died in prison of a liver problem. So it was the two Shepard brothers, Frank and Skip, and their nephew, Brian, Brian's best friend, Richard Brown, and Frank's girlfriend, a woman named Darlene Edwards, who, interestingly, the jury told me they wanted to let Darlene Edwards go. They didn't think that she was guilty, but they misunderstood the judge's instructions in the case, and they thought if they let her go, they'd have to let all of them go, which was a misreading of the jury instructions.
And they're in prison why? What, just in general terms, the evidence that was against them was what?
They were tried under a federal arson statute that basically says if you set an arson fire that kills a firefighter or a public service employee, then you could do life. And there was no physical evidence. It was all destroyed in the explosion. There was no DNA, no tracks in the mud, nothing that put them at the scene. The conviction was based entirely, almost entirely, on these stories told by informants, mm-hmm. many of whom had been in jail with one or the other defendants, saying, yeah, he told me he did it.
Hmm. Just that simple.
Right.
And what, there was some testimony, too, from neighbors who heard some of them coming home that morning. A little bit of that, too.
Well, I've looked at all of the witnesses and interviewed many of them. And probably the most reliable witness was a next-door neighbor to Frank and Skip Shepard, the two older defendants. And she testified that right, I believe, after the first explosion, she saw a truck pull into the driveway next door where the two brothers lived, and she saw four people get out, and two of them were Frank and Skip Shepard. She didn't know who the others were. Hmm. Either couldn't see them because of the dark or didn't know them. And so I'd say she was the most reliable witness. Another very reliable witness was Darlene Edwards' daughter, Becky. Becky was 11 years old at the time of the explosion, and she testified that she remembers when she was 11. Remember, the trial was in 97, the incident was in 88. So Becky Edwards, who was 11 in 88, testified in 97 that she thought she remembered all of the defendants around the kitchen table planning a theft at a construction site. Hmm. She has since recanted that in an affidavit.
Wow. You know, this is a case that sort of continues to offer new leads and new directions here. You wrote in your story in the Star yesterday about a man named Ed Massey who says he was at the construction site that night. Tell us about this new development involving a man named Ed Massey.
Well, Ed Massey's been around for a long time. I interviewed him early on in the process, around 2006.
But somehow he vanished in this whole thing or didn't... didn't engage somehow.
Well, at the time of the explosion, he was interviewed and told him he didn't know anything.
Mm-hmm.
Then he started talking to me in about 2006 or 7, and after numerous interviews, he said, look, I was up there that night. I saw someone set the fires, and it wasn't any of the five defendants. And I don't know why he didn't tell that story to the police in the first place, but unbeknownst to me, in 2006, he went to the ATF and told the same story. Now, I got to tell you, the ATF doesn't believe him, and the federal prosecutor doesn't believe him.
Mm-hmm.
But our editors at the Star at the time said, give him a polygraph test, and we tested him twice. Now, polygraph tests are not admissible in court. He passed both times. Does Ed know what he's talking about? I don't know. There's no corroborating evidence. There's no other witnesses that verify it. But when Ed Massey told that story in 2006 or 7, the U.S. Attorney's Office sent a letter to all the defense attorneys saying, look, there's new information in this case, and by law I have to report it. And that's when the Star stories began.
You know, and again, I sort of go back to where we began this conversation, Mike, but what do you do if you're a prosecutor and you're having witnesses recant, you're having witnesses change stories, you're having witnesses presumably lie blatantly to you? How do you ever unravel what seems to be an tangled mess that you'll never untangle?
I don't know what you do. I think different prosecutors respond in different ways. There is a theory among some prosecutors called the Minister of Justice,
mm-hmm.
in which prosecutors are supposed to take on this mantle of, not only am I here as a prosecutor, but I've got to weigh all the evidence myself, not mm-hmm. just turn it over to a jury. And if I don't think I've got the right people, then I don't go forward. I do believe the federal government thinks that they have the right people. They have said in their report in 2011, we found two additional perpetrators, but we strongly believe that the five people in prison are also still guilty. So what I would love to ask the U.S. attorney is, okay, if we have two new perpetrators, why haven't the five people in prison who are serving life, why haven't they rolled over on these two new perpetrators? Why have they never said, hey, we didn't do it alone?
How often does it happen, Mike, that in long, convoluted cases like this, where the federal government has invested such enormous resources, that the federal government would, you know, years later sit back and say, we made a mistake. We're not sure of our convictions any longer. Does it ever happen?
Yeah, I think it does happen. But there are lots of innocence cases, wrongful conviction cases, where the prosecutor has said, I still don't believe it, even with DNA evidence. And often the family members of the victims don't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
They've been through hell. They've been through the trial. They don't want to admit that the wrong people could be there and they have to go through all this again. And I don't blame them.
Yeah. Let me go to a phone call. Here's Steve from Blue Springs, who's been holding for a few minutes. Steve, you're on Up to Date with Mike McGraw. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. I should make three quick points. I'll keep it very brief.
Please. Wait, just have a couple minutes here.
I went down to the trial one day, sat in a day, and I did not understand one word of it. Number two, I had one of the attorneys that prosecuted is now in private practice in Lee Summit, and I think the guy is crazy and incompetent and a crook, to tell you the truth. Now, you probably don't want me to mention his name. But most of all, I have a friend who arrested all these people who testified and who are in prison. He knew all of them from arresting them. And you know, time and time again, like, we're like a little gang, clique, all buddies. And he says, I don't know how you could take their testimony. You couldn't believe one word they said about anything. So he knew them from arresting them time and time again and making calls.
And that's exactly the point here, right, Mike? Thank you, Steve.
Steve, give me a call later, will you?
Yeah. Maybe we can get Steve's phone number here before he leaves the air. We'll grab it here very quickly. I think we may have lost him here. So this new production is coming out here. It opens up February 4th, Justice in the Embers. And you're not taking part in this thing?
I'm kind of a technical advisor, I guess.
There's a little Henry Fonda in you, though, I think.
No,
isn't there?
No.
I mean, I think there's some potential there.
No, I've got a face for radio. You know that.
Yeah.
I'm kind of a technical advisor. I've read the script several times for accuracy. But with a production like this, I mean, there are real people who live in real life in the script, but there are also people who are like two prison guards who don't really exist in real life, but are antagonist, protagonist talking about the guilt or innocence of these people, which is a great way to kind of look at this issue in depth.
Yeah.
And it's, by the way, it's being directed by Jenna Welch, who's with the Center for Investigative Reporting in the Bay Area. And apparently they have a donor, it was announced last night, who's going to put the play on out in San Francisco.
No kidding.
After it runs here.
A lot of my students are going to come see it, and I will too. Again, that runs, Justice in the Embers, runs from February 4th to the 20th. For tickets, go to kcpt.org. That's the website of Kansas City Public Television. Mike McGraw, continue the good work. Thanks for updating us on what's going on out there. I appreciate it.
Thank you. If the U.S. Attorney ever wants to come on and be with me here, I'd love to do that.
We'll have that conversation anytime.